I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Chris Wood. He is the Vice President for Administration at the Santa Fe Institute, and Greg Heltman, who is the founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. Now, these two institutions, the Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute, have been collaborating, bringing together science and music in very interesting ways. This year, Bach and the Brain, what's it all about?
I think, Chris, I'm going to defer to Chris.
Okay, thanks.
Here, the reason being is really this nugget, this golden nugget idea was put on the table by Chris, and we were so excited about going forward with it, and I think he's most eloquent in describing the depth of what we're going to be presenting on Sunday.
Well, thanks, Greg. That's very generous. A little too generous, I suspect. The idea basically began a very long time ago, long before I was here, long before I knew anything about the symphony, long before I was with the Santa Fe Institute. And when I was a graduate student and was working on some studies trying to understand brain mechanisms, and in that case of speech perception, someone had on the wall a quote from Aldous Huxley. And this quote has stuck with me for a very long time. I'll use it now. We'll also use it in the program on Sunday. It goes like this. The hairy endings of the auditory nerve shuddered like weeds in a restless sea. A vast number of obscure miracles were performed in the brain, and Lord Edwards ecstatically whispered, "Bach." Now, that quote is really self-explanatory. As a neuroscientist, I'm interested in the vast number of obscure miracles in the brain. It so happens that this quote said Bach. It could just as easily have said, if you transposed the novel written in 1928 to the early 21st century, it could just as easily have said, a vast number of obscure miracles were performed in the brain, and Lord Edwards ecstatically whispered, Schnitke. Greg will get that, if nobody else will. And my point is, there is nothing inherently linking the scientific content of this program to Bach. We could perform it with other composers to some loss, but not a great loss. It so happens, though, that Bach is one of my own musical passions, so this coincidence is truly a very, very selfish endeavor on my part.
Well, what's the science component of it?
The concert will consist of an interleaved program of music that Greg will talk about in a moment, I'm sure, interleaved with 3 8- to 10-minute scientific presentations by me that will begin with an examination of what sound looks like in the environment, how sound gets into the brain, what are the mechanisms by which the ear transforms sound in the environment into impulses in the nervous system that the nervous system can process, store, and remember. And we'll then turn, it will follow that information into the brain and turn to the specific mechanisms by which the brain processes sound. And finally, we'll conclude with an examination of what we know about how the brain processes music per se. And are there differences in the brains between musicians and non-musicians, for example?
So, I mean, I think the quotation that you read from Huxley has the word miracles in it, and science is, if anything, a way to turn miracles into non-miracles by explaining things. And there is something that is deeply mysterious to me, maybe to you, maybe not, and that is why music affects us so very, very emotionally when we did not evolve with music.
Well, that's a terrific question. I'll do a typical scientist's reply and first question the premise and then answer the question. We certainly didn't evolve with Bach, Beethoven, and Schnitke, but we did evolve with sound, and part of music is is rhythm. Part of music is the kind of sound that people generate when they're at work in the fields. So it's I think it's a little strong to say we didn't evolve with music. We certainly didn't evolve with composed music.
That's what I'm saying.
But it's easy to think of composed music as being an elaboration of the production, the sound production capabilities we already have, and with the sound perception capabilities that we already have.
But when you listen to nature, and you listen to the music of nature, and you listen to bird songs, and you listen to whale songs, and you listen to the wind through the trees, and all of those things have their beauty and their emotional component and so on, but it's of, to me at least, maybe I'm wrong, a fundamentally different thing than listening to the music of Bach, or even listening to African drumming, or things that have this human composed complexity that doesn't even have an analog, I don't think, in our closest primates.
Well, I think you're right, and I would simply say composers go to great lengths to take advantage of that relationship and try to maximize it for the artistic purposes of their music. But I would gladly wager you that I could lay out an array of music that somebody somewhere in the world calls the same kind of music that has the emotional appeal to them that you were describing, and you would not find all of it emotionally appealing. So
do you think it's mostly cultural, the emotional appeal? It's something that we learn as kids?
I think any nature nurture question of which that is a good example is an oversimplification, in the sense that nature and nurture are so deeply intertwined by definition from the bottom up that simply asking is something cultural is, I think, an oversimplification. Things can be predominantly cultural, but anything cultural is riding on top of the underlying biology, and those mutually evolve, and those mutually constrain each other in very, very interesting and important ways.
I guess the question is there some kind of universality in the what we experience as the depth of music that is cross-cultural, and how do you understand, again, going back to this question, the fact that we are, whatever our culture is, we tend to be so very deeply affected by music, and there's a part of the brain that processes music, and yet, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, how did that part of the brain evolve?
Well, that's a great question, and if I knew the answer to that in detail, we would be a lot farther along than we are today. But let me say that again, I'm sorry to be picky and overly precise, but what you said was there is a part of the brain that processes music, and that's absolutely right. But it's more than that. There are many parts of the brain that process music, many parts of the brain that process both music and non-musical sounds. And to the best of our knowledge, as yet, there is no specific region of the brain that responds to music and only music. And that's part of the really interesting sense in which the brain is not just an individual collection of regions that do specific things, but rather a highly interconnected network with important properties that are shared in some circumstances, are not shared in others. And it's what makes the brain both one of the most interesting, mystifying organs we know, and yet provides great, great challenges for neuroscience to try to understand.
Greg Heltman, what is actually going to be played, and how did you choose the specific pieces by Bach to relate to the scientific content?
As we were having our discussions over the last 6 to 8 months about this idea, there were a number of pieces that were brought to the table. Chris had a quite a lengthy list, and I did too. Stephen Smith, our music director as well, and our principal cellist, Dana Winograd, who participated in the discussions. And as we were going forward, an idea arose of starting with a simpler presentation and then growing till we present the full-size romantic orchestra. And so we're following that model. And we will begin the afternoon, after Chris shares this Aldous Huxley quote with the audience, with a solo performance by David Fellberg of a movement from the sonata in A minor for solo violin. It's going to be quite dramatic. Following that, the brass quintet will come to the front of the stage and perform the Contrapuntus 1 from The Art of the Fugue. The Art of the Fugue by Bach was really an educational, pedagogical piece that he wrote that went through the various designs of fugal writing, and we're presenting the most simplest fugal example with the Contrapuntus number 1. Following that, we are going to go a bit further afield with the Villa-Lobos, Bachianus Brasileiras. Villa-Lobos was very inspired by Bach, as nearly every composer who came after Bach has been, and he wanted to take Bach's models and ideas and put them into a Brazilian idiom. And so the Bachianus Brasileiras for 8 cellos and sopranos is a terrific, terrific example of that style of writing. Our soprano is Natalie Polito, who was one of the second-year apprentices at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. Terrific voice. And then we conclude the first half of the program with the first movement of the Orchestral Suite number 4 in D major. So you see how we grow from one solo instrument to string orchestra with 3 trumpets and timpani. And that's in the first half. In the second half, we go small again with the cantata number 51 for solo, trumpet, soprano, string orchestra. And then we jump to the 21st century with a piece by Paul Moravec entitled Brandenburg Gate. It was commissioned by the Orpheus Ensemble in New York and is modeled on the Brandenburg Concerto number 2. And it features 4 solo instruments, clarinet, trumpet, violin, and flute. And so that's very exciting, very virtuosic. Then we go back into the 20th century with a little piece that I first heard a recording of Benny Goodman playing. It's called Bach Goes to Town.
Nice.
It was written by a British composer, Welsh actually, whose name is Alec Templeton. Alec was born blind, learned to play the piano, became a very successful arranger, pianist, had a TV show in the 50s in the United States with the Cincinnati Symphony, and he wrote a piece called Prelude and Fugue and Swing. And Benny Goodman excerpted the fugue and renamed it Bach Goes to Down. So we'll be playing this big band arrangement with full orchestra. And speaking about full orchestra, we wrap up the afternoon with the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Bach, arranged by Leopold Stokowski.
There was a quote by the abstract expressionist Barnett Newman that goes something like, aesthetics is for artists as ornithology is for birds. To the birds. And I was thinking, I mean, how the brain processes music for you, in a way, doesn't matter, because the music stands alone whether or not we understand how the mechanism of our human apparatus is dealing with it.
I would agree, and I think that what we've lost over the years is this idea that music, whatever its style, can speak to the hearer at that hearer's level, background. And so as one becomes more exposed to a greater variety and diversity of music, one's appreciation of that diversity also grows. But that in no way is meant as a value judgment to those people who find a great deal of enjoyment and inspiration and emotional connection with rock, hip-hop, jazz, that's why I read the jazz piece on here.
Right.
And those examples, I think, speak to this idea that we are still discovering the emotional connection that our brain superimposes on the actual physics, mechanics of sound waves turned into something we've called music.
Let me reply to that question slightly more generally. One of the deepest mysteries that transcends even the mystery of how music is processed in the brain is, what is the brain basis of our experience? Some people use the word consciousness for that. Others prefer not to. That doesn't matter to me for this purpose. But people experience music. People have a conscious, subjective experience of music that's part of what we all enjoy about music. But there is a lot else going on underneath. And what the relationship is between what's going on underneath that enables us to have that subjective experience is sort of the big number one question in neuroscience that may never be answered. Some people, I mean, I think we'll learn a lot more about music in the coming decades, but whether or not we will really be able to understand the neural basis of subjective experience is the $64 question. And I think it's important to recognize in that context that it's the very self-same organ that's trying to do the understanding and trying to do the investigation to understand itself. David Krakauer, a mutual friend.
Another scientist at the Santa Fe Institute.
Yes, thank you. Who's been on your show before,
yeah.
I believe. In his Stanislav Ulam lectures on the evolution of intelligence just a few weeks ago.
Which are amazing and which are up on the net for anybody who didn't make it over
to
the theater.
Exactly. They're on the Santa Fe Institute website, and I urge you, you'll really enjoy them. He led with a quote at one point that said, "It only took 14 billion years for matter to contemplate itself." Now, chew on that for a little bit, and that puts our brains trying to understand themselves and trying to understand how we work to process music in a really appropriate perspective, I think.
Chris Wood is the Vice President for Administration at the Santa Fe Institute. Greg Heltman is the Founder and General Director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. Thank you both so much for
Thank
being
you.
With us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.